Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, the latest novel from Margaret Sweatman is The Gunsmith's Daughter. The titular character, Lilac, leaves her home in remote wilderness for Vietnam, and it's quite the story. Happy to have Margaret on once again here on Turning Pages to talk about this latest book. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, did the character come first, or did the idea for this journey for the character come first? What kind of prompted things?
Well, it was a journey story beginning actually with Huckleberry Finn, the river. And so that led me to the Winnipeg River and then the Mekong Delta and the way that the Delta bifurcates and expands. And then Lilac Welsh and Huckleberry Finn, and Lilac emerged through the journey, through the story, and her relationship with the gunsmith, her father.
So, I mean, had you reread Huckleberry Finn and just it prompted the notion of a river?
I like quest narratives. I think all my books, in a way, are, in a way. And so I liked having her need to seek the sources of her wealth. I grew up during that period of the war and was just starting university in the 70s and living in Edmonton with some people who were the Americans who were dodging the draft. And so we would watch the war on TV. And so I think, in a way, the book is sort of my origins in the rock and roll draft-dodging culture of the 70s. So I also began to research the 60s and 70s. And then, of course, it led to the kind of the centrality of the Vietnam War, what it did to music and politics and youth culture and journalism and writing, because the writing is amazing around that war. So one thing kind of blossoms into the next.
You do cite actual works from reportage and you know, reflections on the Vietnam War. Like, once you had the idea in mind of this Mekong Delta story, did you then kind of start looking at the on the ground reporting from that era to give you the flavor before you started kind of writing the story? Like, what was the process like there?
Yes, I mean, the research is, the existing research and writing that comes from that period. I'm not particularly crazy about Michael Hess's work, but Philip Caputo, for example, wrote an unbelievably beautiful memoir of being in the war called The Rumor of War. And books like that, and Hess, Michael Hare, Dispatches, very stone journalism. And also the women who were there compiled a book called War Torn, and they were in their early 20s and went there. Really, it was a time of very radical feminism and kind of dangerous feminism. They suffered for it. And then I went to Vietnam after I'd done quite a lot of research and scouted out the locations for my novel, not really knowing what would happen there, but knowing, just taking photographs and trying to inhale the locations, the place, and the atmosphere, and also the unbelievable, I would say, arrogance or delusion that the Americans had, and knowing that they were crazy. I think they themselves knew it was crazy to go in and think that they could defeat a national movement like the Viet Cong in that landscape. No matter what technology you had, you just look at the land and you know that this is insane. What they're doing is like trying to conquer another planet.
So thinking or considering that arrogance, was that something that being there gave you that perspective, or was it a combination of that and then the readings that you did?
A bit of both. And I think it wasn't just the American. I think, you know, I'm interested in Canadian politics and history, and our participation in that war was hidden, I think. I mean, I grew up in a very wealthy country, and a lot of the wealth did come from selling nickel and other products to that war effort, and it was disguised. And, you know, 150 people, Canadians died over there, 147 or something like that, or were missing. We did participate, and we got rich. Our economy thrived on that war. War is just so good for business. And so there's, I've always been sort of troubled and amused and horrified by Canadian, our hypocrisy, how pure we always want to be. And so one another very important book for this book was Claire Calhoun's book, Why is Canada in Vietnam? Because she went as a truly a communist nurse and met the horrors of that. And I actually included her in the novel as she really was, because she gave us all permission to use her book. It was without copyright. That was her politics. And so she actually went, and her records of being there and what the Canadians were pretending to go and set up TB hospitals, and they just weren't even staffed. And she was the one who pointed out that what we were doing was collecting information for the CIA on the location of the Viet Cong. So, you know, we were, this holier than thou thing is always prompted me in my writing, in our relationship with the States. And so therefore, Lilac's father is American. So I wanted that kind of, I don't know, I guess allegorical quality to this relationship.
That parent-child relationship, obviously, I mean, plays a big factor in Lilac's life. But, like, was that necessary to kind of suggest the American and Canadian? Because usually it's kind of considered like big brother, little brother kind of vibes, right? Like when we talk politics and stuff, that it's siblings rather than, you know, parental kind of lineage or kind of relationship. It does change the dynamic, but, like, was there a way, a different way to kind of explore this politics without making Cal American? Or did you kind of ever consider anything other than her dad's American and this flavors everything?
Well, yeah, because the weapon that Cal invents was actually invented 10 years later by an American in Tennessee who's still alive, Ronnie Barrett. And it's this 50 caliber or shoulder rifle that has been used at, say, Christchurch and many, many other civilian shootings because that industry needs civilian sales. The military doesn't make them rich enough. They need to sell them to guys at shopping centers. And the NRA politics of intersectional Christianity with very, very violent geopolitics. And also he is a sociologist, and in the 60s, he comes up from University of Michigan, which did send advisors in the early 60s to Vietnam, and he was one of them in my story. Canada didn't have any doctoral students. We didn't have any doctoral programs in the 60s, and he is a professor of sociology. So I also, very early in the process, studied sociology and brainwashing and coercion and manipulation in language. And it was very, very coherent as we went into the Vietnam War period and into the war itself, that a lot of it was the manipulation of public opinion and also the manipulation of people and minds. So one of the, Cal is a psychological operations advisor in the 60s, and is fragged. There were a lot of deaths by frags, which is throwing a grenade at your own senior officer, because there was so much hatred that was generated.
Mm-hmm.
I think it sort of died in the wool. I don't think of our relationship as a sibling relationship with the States. I think it's much more paternalistic and much more oppressive than that.
Mm-hmm. So the Lilac character then, You decide on this parental role for the American, and then obviously she's of mixed nationality. In terms of propelling her story, the inciting incident is a let's say a fan of her father's shows up on their shore, and before heading off to Vietnam, this kid is enlisted. she meets him, and then he leaves, and she starts worrying about him, you know, for lack of a better term, and follows him in a circuitous way. Did you consider how to, like, launch Lilac into the action? Like, what the inciting incident would be, and what was the best way to propel her forward?
Yeah, he propels her. He provokes her into action. I made her 18 in order to kind of turn up the heat on how vulnerable she is, and therefore turn up the heat on her relationships with the people that she meets, because they accept her for what she is, but they also are terrified of having this girl. The other journalists that did go were still incredibly vulnerable, but they were at least 22. She's really still a teenager. And I wanted her to kind of be this Bambi character going in there in order to refresh the perspective and let her experience the horror more with a lot of vulnerability, and also still to feel like a daughter. She loves her father despite everything, and it's very difficult to love certain psychopathy in him, extreme ambition and willfulness. It isn't really the money, it's power that he's after. And this invention scares the hell out of me, you know, such a powerful... The Barrett 50 is a really scary weapon to give to one person. They're built with machine gun caliber. So, yeah, I think I found a way to... I wanted to zero down, narrow, and put all the energy into one focalizer who would be kind of a peeled eyeball, very vulnerable and passionate, and engaged passionately with the characters around her. So it's a coming of age story, but it's accelerated. You know?
Yeah,
it's a novel. It's a story.
Yeah, it's propulsive in that respect. It's interesting you say, you know, you want a character who will engage with the world around her when she starts on an island that her father has built, right? That, like, she essentially is removed from everyone else by his, like, purposeful action.
Yes. I mean, it is kind of that, you know, Paul Thoreau, Mosquito Coast kind of character who wants his family to be that contradiction. They're supposed to be self-sufficient and they're totally dependent on him. So he's kind of that Prospero character, dominating everybody. He's a patriarch. He takes the wind, you know, it's one of the people that helped me with understand him was a serial killer that I read about in one of the final drafts that I was working on. I heard about him on the radio from his daughter's perspective, and that kind of gave me a little more courage to keep going with this bizarre character who is always accommodating whatever environment he's in. He dresses for it, so he can move from place to place. And therefore, she has to come to terms with what her father is, and just the way we have to come to terms with who we are and our relationship with the states and with the Canadian history and situation.
So, when you say you hear an interview with the serial killer and it prompts you to revisit Cal, like what does that entail? Like, do you have to kind of go back in and rewrite some of his lines, or like some of what Lilac describes seeing in him?
It's more, I guess, organic than that. When you're drafting, you often have to start on page one again and live it. So you're not sort of applying anything. You have to experience the book all over again. And gradually the characters become, they begin to heat up and generate more action in themselves and between characters. So you can't, yeah, you can't just sort of add anything. You have to go in from the roots and go under the book again and inhabit it again. It takes a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, it's interesting. You talk about, you know, like adapting this notion that, like, he changes his appearance or his dress for the different environs or the parts. For me, it comes across as he's very clinical, right? Like he's an academic first.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
that he's basically applies himself to some sort of problem that he's trying to solve, but it's always like an interior thing that like the action takes place a lot of the time for Cal within his head.
Well, I don't know. He makes a fortune and he distributes his gun all over the world. He builds a very, very successful hunting rifle first, which is used all over the world and makes him rich.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really participating in the world a lot, but his ambition is quite narcissistic, as ambition can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's pretty worldly, and he's very, very smart. And he does educate his daughter way beyond what a high school ordinarily would. She's homeschooled a lot just because they can't get into Kenora from Manaki area. And he's reading a lot of international journalism. So he's not exactly rustic. He's just extremely skilled in independent living.
Right. I think at one point you refer to, you know, Cal always looked at people like they were problems to solve, I think is one of the things you describe. And you talk about, you know, kind of like that he claimed friends, even though he didn't seem to have the capacity for friendship, that like it's
his don't you know people like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's a fascinating thing. It's just part of the picture of like that kind of like clinical detachment, right? Like that he's like, particularly as a sociologist, trying to remove himself from the observational, I mean, which we've all like determined is a fallacy, right? Like that, by being studied, subjects are altered.
Yeah. And he was, and he did study brainwashing and coercion and methods of manipulating the masses. I mean, that's what sociologists did. One of the first people I talked to when I was beginning to understand Cal, the very, very beginning, many years ago, was Angus Reid, who's family friend. And so he led me to some other sociology texts from the 50s and 60s.
Mm.
And they were looking at what massive movements and massive cognition. So it's a major study, and especially at the beginning of that war. It's a fascinating aspect of sociology. I think sociology now has probably become much more social work, kind of, but when it began, you look at what they were looking at, the leisure class and the warrior class, and how they can interact and how the warrior class can manipulate the intellectual class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's scary stuff.
Right. I want to pivot away from Cal for a second, even though it's called The Gunsmith's Daughter, and so he looms very large in the fact that, like, even in the title, he's the possessive one. But Lilac, as a character, before she goes to Vietnam, she lands in Winnipeg and gets a job writing for the Winnipeg Tribune. And
yeah,
I guess in part because this is kind of what then affords her the opportunity to then go to Vietnam, you had to kind of figure out, like, how does she end up in Vietnam? Covering it as a young journalist is kind of your entry point. But like, were there other ways to get her there, or was it this allowed you to talk about writing in some way?
I'm not, I don't really like the metafictional. I didn't want this book to be self-conscious. It's not a postmodern novel. And I felt a little bit uneasy about it being about writing. I didn't want it to be. But it also, because she was my focalizer, she was my camera eye, it helped that she was a writer. And I could practice seeing through her eyes to try and record the way she would and what she would absorb from her elders. Larry Donovan's a Pulitzer Prize, one of the characters in the book, is a photojournalist, and he's training her very, very kindly and compassionately and scared to death all the time, wanting her to go home.
Mm-hmm.
This child is there. So he takes her on to try and help her, but also to save her life. So I guess it helped that she was a writer, because she was my recording device and she was my camera. I didn't really want the book to be about writing. She's my character. So, and she was really talented. I really admire her. I wish I had her courage.
Do you bump up against what you have to write about her as a writer then, as a writer yourself? Like, does that create any friction, or, you know, are you trying to tell some sort of truth about your own thoughts on writing? Because I'm thinking a spot at which, like, Lilac describes herself as a vampire who used the desperation and bravery of a young man to advance herself, a calculating parasite who watched to absorb nutrients from the bones of the living. Now, obviously, as a novelist, you're not telling, like, real people's stories, but I have to imagine you do seed your stories with real experiences, as you, you know, talked about pulling from, you know, the Nurse Claire's book and from real stories of Vietnam. Like, is there a worry that that's something in the back of your head?
No. I don't feel like a vampire. I think that a war journalist would suffer that concern. When you're writing about cruelty, how do you write about cruelty? I mean, Susan Sontag writes about this. You know, what happens when you are writing about cruelty? And when I was reading the accounts, at the back of The Gunsmith's Daughter, there is a list of books, and this book is called War Torn, and they're memoirs of the young women who went. And they suffered from that anxiety. What am I doing here? How am I watching suffering? How do we watch and record suffering? But I mean, I'm not a journalist of any kind, and certainly not a wartime journalist. So I was writing about a character, mm-hmm. and imagining how she would feel, this young woman, and she was terrified by her own success. I just imagine that would be plausible. So, you know, it's really creating a fictional character.
I did love the eye-opening experience she has when she's sitting in a deli counter and reading and realizes, wait a second, real people write this and they live here.
Yeah.
That this isn't some far-off thing like reading the Maclean's magazine or something, that it's the immediacy of it and the, like, potential that existed for her in that moment.
Yeah. She's invigorated and she's freed and, she takes action. She gets her own agency. She's really got a lot of jam. I'm fond of her.
Yeah. So, in terms of building the interiority of a character like Lilac, then you said you specifically chose that she would be about 18, so that she's wide eyed. She's more innocent. You know, that she has this relationship with her father, the American, and. Like, what else, like, do you map out or, like, start kind of, like, jotting down ideas of, like, her personality before you start writing her? Or do you discover her personality as you start writing her action?
Yes, she comes from action. I think that particularly novels or the way I approach novels, you live the situation and the character emerges from situation. I think that, like, right now I'm working a little bit at an adaptation for television of one of my other novels. I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but I'm studying how television writing goes, and I think what you're suggesting works for that medium, mm-hmm. Where you actually have to crack open and you're looking for contradictions in characters and habits that will identify that character on the screen in a 40-minute or hour-long or 2.5-hour-long section. That's, I think, more surgical. But with novels, I think you live the characters, and it's a lot more fun. I think that it is always starting on page one. When you discover something new, you have to start at page one to knit the spider web all over again. It's a very fragile kind of network. So the characters, I don't do character studies. I think about them when I'm stuck at red lights or when I can't sleep. I don't necessarily think about them. I just invite them in and listen to them and hope they'll show up.
So you place her in a situation like when she first goes to Vietnam and there's, you know, an attack and she's, you know, concussed in the bombing, and then she finds herself, you know, having a high-level interview that she probably shouldn't merit at that point, and then it's like, what would she do in these situations? And you suss out, like, who she is by how she's handling these things.
Yeah, you live in her body and see, because you have to light a scene and you have to do your depth of field. She's my camera. And so I set the lighting a lot first, and then I want to know, like, she's very hungry. She's got a very high metabolism. So I know that she's hungry and she's in pain and she's scared to death. And then I go in there with her and have fun with her. She's my guide. So you imagine, it's like in a long hallucination. You enter her dream and try to inhabit it. What does it feel like to fall off a bench because of a concussion, a concussive force of a big bomb? What's it like to see a leg come to the surface of a river and then go down again? And what does it smell like? And you have to kind of be careful not to diminish your characters out of some sort of false modesty that, you know, ordinarily when we're talking about ourselves, we don't want to enhance our ego verbally. And you can't do that with characters either. You have to give them their full due and let her really move around and have a look. So they show you stuff. Like, I didn't know that she was going to walk in and see this sort of French washroom at this restaurant. But there it was, you know. If you do the research and you sort of digest the research and let it live in you, and then you put the film in her mind and then go with her. So you dream it.
So when you go through, a hallucination process like this, coming out the other side, do you wrestle with any kind of like PTSD from kind of dealing with some of these things?
I did. After it was published, a friend of mine, Barb Schott, a poet, we went to a shooting range. It was published. And about a few weeks later, I felt compelled to go and shoot an assault rifle. And I was really traumatized shooting this gun. Mm. My body went crazy. I had to stop. I just felt compelled to touch one. But the book was already published. We launched it. And I can't remember. We launched it in May, and we went in June to this shooting range. And I handled the kind of gun that my soldier Gavin would have been handed. It wasn't an M16, but it was another type of AR-style assault rifle. And brought all the kind of horror. I got so tired, frankly, researching this book, of looking at these guns. Mm. And then having to touch one and embrace it and put your cheek against it and pull the trigger and then endure the sound, I went pale and I was just trembling. And my friend, she had a lot more gumption, and she had to take over my cartridges and shoot the rest of them. I couldn't stand it. I don't feel traumatized. The research, you know, the horrors of the actual, say, the scenes in the hospitals in the Gunsmith's Daughter is, I honor the researchers who gave that information to me. And I wrote to one of them, she's a prof out east, and thanked her, and she gave me permission to use her research, and we kind of shared our sadness over what we were reporting. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel, I'm on to something else. You get on to something else.
Sure enough.
Yeah.
Well, the book is out through Goose Lane Editions, The Gunsmith's Daughter. Margaret Sweatman, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it.
It's very nice to talk to you, always. Thanks a lot.